Welcome, everyone, to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson. My co-hosts are John Gee and John Thompson. Our discussion topic for this podcast is an interview with a special guest, Jonathan Stapley. Jonathan has just released a book, or it's near release any week now, Holiness to the Lord, Latter-day Saint Temple Worship, published by Oxford. And Jonathan has written other books, and we'll talk about that as we interview him, but we're glad to have him on our podcast. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what the Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. And if you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. You can give us a good rating. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast app where you get your podcast information. Now, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. And I would just point out to you that the Interpreter Foundation is a 501c3 corporation. In other words, all of your donations to the foundation are tax deductible. There's even a section on the website where you can go and see exactly where the money goes. Nearly 100% of the people involved with the Interpreter Foundation are volunteers. And so you can be sure that there's not a lot of overhead being covered in terms of what we're offering. But I am really excited about our discussion topic. This book has been in the work for years. So we have Jonathan Stapley, as I mentioned, and he's the author of Holiness to the Lord, Latter-day Saint Temple Worship. Jonathan, welcome to the Interpreter Foundation, and tell us a little about yourself.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And it's an honor to meet and chat with you guys. So I'm Jonathan Stapley. My byline is I'm a historian and scientist. Like a lot of folks that study the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I have a background that kind of is circuitous on its way to history. I have a PhD in chemistry, carbohydrate chemistry from Purdue University. I dissertated in 2004, but since that time I've been along with building a company based on my graduate research. I've been researching and writing in Latter-day Saint history and kind of religious history generally since that time. I've generally published on topics that deal with worship, liturgy, authority, those types of ideas.
Okay.
How did you get interested in worship and liturgy particularly?
So for me, you know, being trained as a scientist, it primed me to think through ideas in ways of models. So I had ideas. I'm a practicing Latter-day Saint, have been my whole life, and I kind of had a model of how things work. And when I started researching and writing, or starting researching Latter-day Saint history, it was 2004, and universities were just beginning to digitize their holdings. And so I was doing primary document research. And look, it's not difficult to go into journals or meeting minutes and find ideas and practices that may not line up with our experience today. So for me, I was fascinated by women's healing. And that was a practice that didn't really fit within the model that I had. And as a scientist, look, if you can demonstrate that prevailing models are incorrect, you get a prize. You're a winner. You get promoted or whatever. If you can offer a compelling counter model, particularly. And so for me, this was just tremendously exciting. This idea that, wow, the way I saw things maybe wasn't particularly accurate, and I've got an opportunity to find new ways of understanding. So I jumped headlong into it. It was fun.
So you wrote a book about 7 years ago, and it was called The Power of Godliness,
yep.
Mormon Liturgy and Cosmology. And now you've come into the temple, but they seem to be intertwined. Tell us what the relationship is between the two books.
Yeah, certainly. So a big question addressed in the first book was, what is priesthood? And I think It's uncontroversial, particularly among folks that have lived in the last decade, that have matured in the last decade, because we've seen when President Oaks introduced a new way of understanding priesthood in General Conference a little over a decade ago. And we've developed new ways of talking about women in priesthood. And so, what a particular puzzle for me was the way we Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo talked about priesthood in relation to temple, and how conceptions of priesthood seem to develop over time. And so, for me, that was a primary impetus for that first study. And I was dealing with a bunch of ritual practices that interact with that those conceptions of priesthood. But clearly, fundamental to that was this. The idea that when Joseph Smith started performing the temple ceremonies in Nauvoo, when you look at the documents that the people who participated with him left, they called themselves the priesthood. That they were a quorum of priesthood, or they were the holy order of priesthood. And I think a lot of scholars in the 80s and 90s wrestled with some of that data and, in my opinion, maybe drew conclusions that were inaccurate. And so this was my chance to offer a competing framework of understanding what was happening with regard to priesthood. And that, I mean, obviously leads right into a book about the temple because they're like directly related.
So you worked on this for a long time, and what were some of the challenges that you faced as you were doing the research on it?
Specifically with the book on the temple. So I would say, I mean, I don't think that there's a tremendous amount of hurdles in doing work like this. It's just the standard challenges to any sort of historical project where you do the spade work and you have to read a lot of primary sources and do that sort of research. You know, coming up with good ideas is not obvious and hard, and maybe I didn't come up with many. I've got a few that I like, but I think, you know, for me, I think the beginnings of this book in particular, I've been keeping files on the topics addressed in this book for a long time. They've grown over the decades. But I have a son who left on a mission in COVID in 2020, and he was getting ready to go to the temple. And I think that's when I started writing the first chapter of this book, which was just a description. I'm like I said, I'm practicing Latter-day Saint, and I've taught temple prep for a long time. And my wife and I kind of have a spiel where we just walk people through what happens. We don't think people should necessarily be surprised when they or freaked out when they go to the temple. And so it was just writing down, like narrating what happens in a way that doesn't that I felt didn't betray the confidences of the community. And so that was the beginning of the project.
Well, let me just, I wanted to comment on this anyway. I think so, given that that first chapter, given the challenge of walking through what happens without disclosing things that are sacred, and I'm not a church leader, so as far as I can tell, you skated through that about as well as I think anyone could do.
Yeah, I agree.
I
Glad
will take
you.
that. Thank you.
I think that is it's sensitively done, and I think you managed to do that, to say as much as you can without divulging anything secret or sacred, rather, about it. But again, I'm not a church leader, so I may be missing something, but as far as I can tell.
Well, thank you. So far, I'll live with that.
So, well, the reason I asked, I guess, is the tenth temple tends to be a sensitive topic where people are reluctant to talk about what goes on there. So I was wondering if there were any kinds of hurdles because of that. So when we study some ancient practices, obviously there are secrets that are just not divulged, and
Yeah,
there
I
are
mean, I
certain
think
areas.
it's I was lucky in my timing. Look, in the last not quite a decade, the church has really increased the information available about the temple. In the 1970s and 80s, there were specific written instruction not to disclose the temple covenants. And we publish those in the Strength of the Youth pamphlet now. We've put images of the garment and temple robes online. And I think there is an opportunity now that maybe wasn't available even a decade ago to write something like this.
So for me, I really appreciated the way, like John and John said, the way that you walked through the first chapter, and then there's a history of the kind of the some of the ceremonies and as they changed from Kirtland to Nauvoo, and yet how they were similar, which is something that I think a lot of people fail to realize. For a long time, many observations that I've seen have been, okay, it was different in Kirtland and different in Nauvoo. But you seem to make those connections, okay? But then we get to some of the changes that come later. And one of the ones I was going to ask you about is it seems as though the place of women in the temple changed between Joseph and Brigham, and that now it seems to have kind of changed back. At least
Yeah,
that
I mean,
was the impression I got from your book.
so I'm making a specific argument. I think I've got the receipts in the footnotes for people that care about that sort of thing. I make a specific argument about, and I know this is a term that's kind of tricky, but the subordination of women in the cosmology of church leaders. If you look at the sealing text that the Joseph Smith papers published, that Joseph Smith produced, it was a revelation. And you compare that to the sealing text that Orson Pratt published in 1852, that probably we know that Brigham Young wasn't stoked that he did that, but it's on the church's website, so you can I should say it's on the Church History Library catalog and the BYU Library catalog website. You can view the original documents. And we can compare those, and then we can compare how church leaders talked about the relationship. And I think there is a compelling case that there was a more egalitarian relationship with Joseph Smith. Where it was kings and queens, priests and priestesses to God. And with Brigham Young, he preferred queens and priestesses to their husband. Now, I generally like to write and research things where there's mountains of sources and data and just be overly confident in what I'm saying. We're dealing with fewer sources here. So I think people could rightly criticize this frame, th this this idea, but I'll be interested to see how people respond to that in particular.
But it seems to have changed in the other direction more recently, at least as we experience changes that have been going on through Revelation in the temples
Yeah, I
as
think
we've gone
there's no
forward.
question that church leaders, I mean, and this is going on over 3 decades now. Have introduced a more egalitarian languages to the language to the ceremonies.
Actually, over five.
Yeah, there you go.
5 decades?
Yeah.
Okay. That's
First heard
true.
about this in the 70s.
Yeah. I received my endowment in the 1979, and there's been some changes since. But when I talked to my mother, who's 92, and when I talked to my grandfather, in fact, my grandfather went on a mission in 1926, and he said there was a substantial change when he came back 3.5 years later. So you kind of address those as we go, Jonathan. So what challenges did you find doing this for Oxford? as opposed to maybe an LDS publisher?
I don't, there wasn't really much by way of challenge to do it. I think my first book sailed through peer review. This one was more difficult. Part of that is because my first book is intentionally sort of technical, and has a kind of more sophisticated register, and I wanted this book to be more accessible. And so I, in my first draft, I tried writing to insiders and outsiders at the same time. And the reviewers didn't love that. And so I rewrote with the idea of speaking to outsiders. My editor was like, look, the insiders will come along for the ride, I promise. And so I think that was my biggest challenge, was just finding, like, writing to the correct audience. And I really wanted this to, land well. And so I circulated it among a lot of my friends who are practicing as well as those outside of the faith. And I look, it's never going to be perfect, but I feel like I got somewhere that was workable.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was a good balance of trying to again, walk somebody through the temple that hadn't been there before, to give them that sense, that overview, but also then to tie it back into history and give it a little bit of depth as well. So, yeah, I thought overall it did a really good job of that.
So, where did you decide to kind of make a cutoff? Because a lot of times when people write about the temple or the temple ceremony, I mean, especially in some of our work and some of the work of the Interpreter Foundation and others, we try and tie it in more with antiquity, or at least to show relationships and things. And you don't really do that in your book, and it seems as though that's a conscious choice. What's kind of the framework of that decision on your part?
A part of that is just my competency. I don't think I'm competent to speak to a lot of those issues. I'm a historian of America, like Atlantic Christianity, more broadly, and probably, anything after 1600, I'm comfortable with. I also think that, at least for the work that I'm doing and the data that I see, I think there is certainly value to looking at antiquity. Like I said before, I really like to work where there's just a lot of data. And Latter-day Saints, man, they do data well. We've got mountains of records. That describe what's happening in, the 19th century and beyond. And so that's a focus. I also think I'm really, really interested in the religious work that the temple is doing. And less, I mean, I have to address kind of ritual mechanism, but I'm much, much more interested in the religious work that the liturgies do. And
So more of a
so,
perception of that work by
yeah,
the
like how did
populace.
Joseph Smith narrate it? Now, whether or not there, like I said, there may or may not be ancient antecedents. If he drew that connection, then I'm gonna emphasize that more than, yeah. Again, I don't think I can speak competently to ancient practice.
Okay. So
Well,
I know the two Johns had some questions too, and then I'll come back to some of my own.
I know John has several very good questions prepared, which he's shared with you. I'm just going to pick up on what you just talked about. And the one ancient source, well, you use a couple. You use the Book of Revelations and you use the Book of Abraham. And I was surprised, by a connection that several people have drawn. I didn't see that with the Book of Abraham, and that Joseph Smith was working on the Book of Abraham usually 2 or 3 months before he does something with the temple. So this happens in Kirtland, just before the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, and the preparatory endowment they received there. And then he's doing it again in Nauvoo and publishing it just before he reveals the endowment there. And so a lot of people have made that connection. I didn't see that in the book. Maybe I missed it. So I was a little surprised at that. But there was one comment you made, and I'd like maybe a little bit of an explanation on this. As you talked about how scholars have only recently begun to approach the Book of Abraham with sophistication, and you cite the work of Brian Hoglund and Matt Gray. And what about their work did you see as sophistication, as opposed to some other works that have been?
No, I appreciate the question and the sensitivity of it. So just to backtrack a little bit, I think you're right to note those connections. I talk about in the Nauvoo section how Joseph Smith incorporates elements of the Book of Abraham into the liturgy. And so you're absolutely right that it's directly connected. I'm not sure that I see the evidence for the practice of what's happening, because it's in January that he introduces washings and anointings, 36. He's been saying we're going to do an endowment, be endowed, and God has revealed that we're going to have an endowment of power in my house several years before that. That's something that I should think about. I need to reconsider that. I will confess that I probably have been impatient and not gone through as much of the previous literature, the kind of the back and forth. It's hard for me, like discussions about scroll length and things like that. I think I have on the timing of the production of the Book of Abraham, I'm probably inclined to be more sympathetic to like the Joseph Smith papers.
Well, they have two views. Yeah, there's
As presented in R4, I should say.
okay.
I'm probably that seems to resonate with me, but again, I'm a lot more interested on the Book of Revelation as scripture and what its meaning to the Latter-day Saints. Like that's really what I'm particularly interested in. And consequently, and look, Sam Brown's a friend. And so I'm going to like, and I started researching and writing with him and that kind of generation of scholars. So I have an affinity for that. I think Matt Gray's work is particularly interesting, but on the way Joseph Smith uses Hebrew generally, like that's wild. I think that's just such important work, because we invest terms like eternal lives and seeds with a tremendous amount of religious weight. And in context of Joseph Smith's use of Hebrew, I think really opens those early terms to new interpretation. But I appreciate the pointer. I should have been more fair, probably.
Just wondering what you were seeing there. This is a little more my bailiwick, and so I'm curious as to what you found compelling. And thank you for answering that. I think I'm going to let John ask some of his questions.
Going back just to like the beginnings of your book, I think it's interesting how you kind of portray even like the preparations the Latter-day Saints go through as they prepare to go to a temple. Even went into the questions in our temple interviews and those kinds of things. You know, it's a really nice, comprehensive take on this experience, along with that historical background to it. On temple prep in particular, I don't know. You didn't really spend a lot of time going into the history of that. You did kind of brush on it, so but I don't know if you maybe have a lot of background research into that area. But you know,
The
have did
footnotes, a lot of the candy is in the footnotes
yeah,
on
yeah.
those bits.
So I didn't know if there was, you know, you did mention in the book that the temple prep courses have been kind of maybe a little hit and miss, and maybe not as rigorous or not as helpful as they could be, just because we have this culture of trying to not talk about the temple, but then you're trying to talk about it in a prep course. So, as you've looked at that idea, you know, is there anything that you learned about what was and what wasn't effective, and if there's a better way of doing this, maybe moving forward?
I think that we as an inst the church as an institution is still trying to figure out how to do this, and communicate and teach about the temple. That's something we're still learning how to do. I think that, like I mentioned, they were at the beginning of his administration, President David O. McKay and the Quorum of the Twelve are talking about this idea that people are going to the temple, becoming disoriented and leaving the church, and they don't know what to do. They have this sense of sacredness and culture of privacy around the temple, and it's decades before they've come up with a formal curriculum. And in the footnotes, I walk through kind of the progression of what that looks like. Again, for the folks that like the candy,
Yeah.
read the footnotes throughout the book. There's a lot of discursive ones. What I will say that this one I found after the book was finished, but I was really, really surprised. I've been going back and reading the young women's manuals from the 70s, and they are super, super transparent with the temple. They talk about the temple recommend questions when though you should we weren't allowed to share those. They're printed in the Young Women's Manual. So I think I need to learn more about what was going on there and who was writing those manuals, because I think it's a real interesting disjuncture from the general trends. And look, it's not that the temple prep classes are bad. It's just they don't really talk about the temple that much.
Yeah, and I was teaching young soldiers back in 1990 when we were getting ready to go to Iraq. I was in charge of the temple prep class, and we had a manual at that time that essentially reviewed the missionary lessons. Didn't have a word about the temple. I did
So all
not use it.
good
I did not
things.
use it. Yeah, no, but I did not use it. We talked about symbolism. We tried to help them understand how the temple was a different experience and tried to prepare them to go in there. Now, of course, with like you experienced with the chapter of your book, we have a lot more openness from the church, but that's only in the last 10 years, really. So we've really had to go on our own with that. And I remember being in a meeting with, I believe it was Elder Werthelin, down in St. George, where he was specifically asked the question about that. And he said, "We have been working on a temple prep manual for the last 3 years, and a new one is coming out." And this is when they did away with the yellow one that had the missionary lessons, and they brought the white one out that began to talk about the endowment in a little more clear fashion.
Which is actually still our current one, isn't it? So
I don't
I don't
know.
think we've updated
I
that since the
yeah,
80s or
probably
whatever that
not.
was, you know. So
But that was the
I've heard
90s. I don't have any insider knowledge about this, but I've heard rumors that there's going to be a new one, but
well, they've been, you know, some of my colleagues in S&I couple decades ago were involved in a rewrite, but that never came out. So I don't know where things stand at this point. So, but another question I have, we talked a little bit earlier about women experiences in the temple and Joseph Smith's framing versus Brigham Young's. I am curious, since you've done a lot of work on, women healing blessings and those kinds of things, I think it's pretty clear that if you think about the Old Testament initiation into priesthood, when Aaron, before Aaron and his sons can serve, they have to be washed, anointed, and clothed, and they have a ritual meal. And then after they go through that ceremony, they then can start officiating in the temple. They can start doing sacrifices and those kinds of things. So if you take just that model alone, I think we can safely say that men and women are being initiated into priesthood, into an Aaronic order, and then ultimately a Melchizedek order, through the temple, in the same way that the priests of old were initiated. And so then the question, that we ask is, so what is laying on of the hands all about, right? Because we will lay hands on a 16-year-old young man, and just through that act alone, not through washing, anointing, clothing like Aaron had to go through, but just through the act of laying on of hands, he is fully authorized to officiate as a priest in every ordinance that a priest can do. So then what's the point of the temple, since he's already got, it seems, all the authority that he needs? And then why doesn't Joseph Smith, once he starts w ordaining women into the priesthood through the temple, why doesn't he do the laying on of hands? I think there's some ideas out there that probably could be explored as to why that disconnect of men being ordained by laying on hands, women are not. Even though they both are being ordained, using that word kind of a little loosely, or probably more originally how it's used, even though they're both being ordained to priesthood through temples.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really awesome question. And I'm going to try to answer it in a coherent way. But I'll just confess that it's somewhat chaotic in Nauvoo, right? So we all try to systematize things and make sense of it. I think I try my best to do that, but I'm quite aware that there are some things that maybe don't fit in the way I explain it. So what I will say is, and again, I'm not an A&E scholar, but my understanding is that priests in the Israelite temple are consecrated. They are made ritually pure and set apart and made holy to function in the office of temple priest. In the New Testament, elders are ordained, often with the laying on of hands. And in the Latter-day Saint mind, it is also that it is not making the person holy or separate. It's a conferral of ecclesiastical or religious authority. I've only seen speculations about the laying on of hands. Now, the laying on of hands is wildly controversial in Christianity, not among Catholics or Orthodox folks, but among Protestants. And if you look at the Catholic ordination liturgy, they reference the consecration of Hebrew priests or Israelite priests, but Protestants most certainly do not. And even whether or not you should lay on hands in Protestantism is controversial. So with that sort of background, Joseph Smith ordains people to ecclesiastical priesthood offices, and that exists in the church. And my argument is that Joseph Smith is materializing the priest, this body of kings and priests that he sees in the vision of John, and materializing that on earth. So heaven is this thing, and we are going to construct it in the present. And so the washings, the anointings, the consecration, it's not the full consecration ceremonies of Exodus. There's no sacrifice, the meal, all of that. It's not complete, but what it's doing is it's materializing elements of that to construct this heavenly priesthood, this body of priests. And so women are included necessarily in Joseph Smith's cosmology. Women must be in that vision. So it's not just kings and priests, it's queens and priestesses. And the way we make that is through the temple. So I don't want to say they're non-overlapping spheres on the Venn diagram of priesthood. They clearly are. But if we want to make kings and queens, priests and priestesses, then we use the temple to do it. If we want to make deacons, teachers, priests, and elders, we use ordination. And look, I actually have, I'm working on an essay right now that is a contextual reading of Doctrine and Covenants 25, Emma's ordination, and read in context. Like if a Presbyterian read that when it was dictated, he would have freaked out. He would have said, you're ordaining women to the priesthood, is the only contextual reading of that. Now, that's not how it plays out in our tradition, but I think there's interesting things to work on there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I have a different perspective and a different framework that I've been working on. I published a paper on restoring Melchizedek priesthood that kind of tries to untangle all of the, different statements of Joseph Smith of, that this is Melchizedek priesthood. No, this is Melchizedek priesthood, and it seems like he's conflicting or he's contradicting himself. And I think some historians have kind of pointed that out to say that Joseph Smith is evolving his ideas. I think there's a more clear path through that mess, but when it comes to women in the priesthood, I've wondered if the temple is, Joseph Smith's effort to basically collect everything in the gospel and the church into this into a framework that ultimately, as you said, will become the heavenly family and heavenly priesthood. And so I don't really see what he's doing in the church as being necessarily separate. I know you mentioned the overlapping in that Venn diagram, but I see them overlapping probably a lot more than most maybe. And I've wondered if Joseph's creation of chains of authority through the laying on of hands is meant to echo ancient concepts of priesthood as inheritance that does get fulfilled, as it were, in the temple when we create our chains of family. But since it's a patriarchal inheritance in the ancient world, then it seems that it's something that only men in, participate in as a symbol that the inheritance comes into the family through the husband. But then once it's in the family, the husband and wife can then be initiated into all those orders together. Anyway, it's longer discussion,
Yeah, interesting.
I'll share that with you later.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Jonathan, one of the other questions that I had was, what did you discover during the writing of this book that surprised you? What are one or two of the things, and what surprised you the
Yeah.
most?
I mean, so much of this is, collecting documents over decades, right? And there's going to be lots of moments of like, oh, I can't believe this document exists. It's so cool. I think probably the material on race, when we were like researching how involved several groups of Native Americans were in temple ceremonies in the 19th century was really eye-opening and moving and poignant to me. You had the survivors of the Bear River Massacre. They're the Northwestern Band of Shoshone. Quite some time after that massacre, they have religious experience visions that lead them to the church. They're baptized, and they ultimately experience the temple and the endowment house. And they help build the Logan Temple and participate in proxy work there and are doing proxy work for Oftentimes we you'll see grandparents and great grandparents in the temple, like as people doing work for their grandparents and great grandparents, and with this group you see cousins and sons and daughters and siblings. It's just tremendously poignant to me, and so like that was one of my favorite bits.
One of the things that that struck me as I was going through it was, we're familiar with, okay, we read a statement, Joseph did the Washington anointings in January of 1836. But you break that down a little more because you said, wait a minute, this was totally unusual for somebody of Joseph Smith's time in Kirtland. Nobody bathed in the winter. It was an effort for these guys to wash and to cleanse themselves and to scent themselves with oil. And it was just usually in our histories, we don't recognize the physical difficulties of what they were doing. And yet here it was brought out in this one instance, and it really opened my eyes to say, wait a minute, he is totally doing something different here in order to set it apart.
I mean, for me, it's hard to empathize, like religiously, what sort of transformation occurs in the temple. I mean, I've read like people kvetching at the turn of to the 20th century about people not bathing and not showering, like encouraging people to be clean when they go to the temple because they smell bad or whatever. But there's when I experience the temple today, I don't experience any sort of embodied change. I may wear different clothes, but I don't have a physical ch change. Whereas these early saints truly did. They like life was filthy, and to have a clean body, clean clothes, to be perfumed, is a complete shift in embodiment and religious time and religious space. That it's, I think it's really hard, difficult for us to empathize with, frankly.
John, did you have another question, John Gee?
I know I've answered or posed the questions that I've mainly got, and I know John had Thompson had some others.
I thought it was interesting that you were looking at the earlier practices of when the missionaries went out, of shaking the dust off their feet as commanded by the Lord, right? If someone rejected them, kind of as a curse and a testimony that they've done their duty, right? That they're clean from the sins of those people that have rejected them. I think if I'm reading it correctly, right, you're taking that and you're bringing it into the temple as part of the washing and anointing that occurs. That's kind of like an early manifestation of that. And I've thought a little bit about this. The Christian world kind of has taken the priestly washing and made it into baptism. Which is kind of an interesting conflation, I think, that we would see as conflation because we see them as separate things. But I'm just curious if you have thought about like what is the difference between baptism and washing, anointing, and clothing, which the Christian world would consider baptism. Why do we keep them separate?
So one thing, being a liturgist, I do spend a lot of time looking at the history of things like baptism, and the ancient liturgies there. So I do have some competence to speak to that. And I think like kind of those 4th and 5th century baptismal liturgies are fascinating and lovely. I'm always going to defer to kind of a contextual reading. So Latter-day Saints today, if you, I think if you, like we can do the Family Feud thing where you ask 100 people and then what the number one answer is going to be, and there's going to be some subsequent ones. I think the number one answer today is if, like, why are you baptized? I think most people would say, because I want to make covenants with God, or some variation of that. And then under there would maybe be forgiveness of sins somewhere below that today. I think during Joseph Smith's time, so the idea of making covenants at baptism hadn't developed yet during Joseph Smith's time. And I think baptism unto repentance or for the forgiveness of sins was the dominant way of understanding the work of baptism. And so, beyond that, so, oh, go
I need
ahead.
to interject just real quick, though. Of course, the Book of Mormon puts it into a covenant context rather than the forgiveness of sins a lot, right?
Actually, so I've got an essay on this coming out, I think next year or the year after, and I'd be happy to send you a copy of it, where I actually argue precisely the opposite.
Okay, so you like Noel Reynolds' paper on this, I guess you're addressing, because he actually dealt with this idea of what baptism was for.
Okay, I
Several
should probably look
papers.
closer at that. I may have read it, but I think I think I've got a pretty bulletproof case. We'll see. Then you have these other washings. So what work are they doing? So the revelations say you need to be declared clean from the blood and sins of this generation, and you have to, in order to do that, you have to go preach the gospel first, right? You have to preach the gospel and then be welcomed into the covenant community as being clean from the blood and sins of this generation. And that is clearly introduced into the temple liturgy. But there's this kind of buffer in between early Kirtland and Nauvoo, where some, like Wilford Woodruff, is a fantastic example. So he's an early evangelist. He learns about the feet washing and the dusting and the cleansing of the feet, but he also has his sins declared, or he also experiences the liturgy in Kirtland in 1837, a year after most everybody else, and has is declared clean from the blood and sins of this generation. And so when he goes out and labors, and after that experience, he goes and maybe finds somebody that he feels he needs to testify against. Again, this is all done privately, not in front of anybody. He goes to a river, cleans his feet, and says, I clean my feet as a testimony, and then I'm clean from the blood and sins of this person. So he's kind of conflating it individually because there's no general handbook, right? There's no liturgical texts, there's no catechism. People are working with these ideas in interesting ways. And then once we get to Nauvoo, it's formally integrated into the temple ceremonies. And then I think that's when we have a real deprecation of missionaries doing that. Like, I remember when I was a missionary in the 1990s, my mission president was like, don't even pretend to like wash your feet against anybody, right? And there's a whole folklore about it. It's like, just don't do that. I think it's officially deprecated. I mean, there's bits and pieces of it you see kind of on the folk level. But then and the question of becoming clean from the blood and sins of this generation is specifically germane to the in Kirtland, it's associated with feet washing. In the Nauvoo temple, that gets associated with the initiation washings. And again, we have documentation where it says, women, that's where we see the introduction of the disparity in liturgy for women, because women are not public ministers. They don't preach the gospel. Therefore, they don't have to do work to become clean. So I don't see anybody asking the question of what did this mean to Aaron and the ancient priests in Israel. I don't see anybody asking that question. If I would love to know if they were asking that question. I mean, there's all sorts of things I wish people documented, and hope to find one day, but that would be super amazing.
Well, there is definitely, I think, evidence in the Hebrew Bible of Aaron and the priests being cleansed from the community, right? And so the idea of
Yeah,
being
I mean
clean from
that
the
sense of purity, right? Ritual purity.
and it's not just their own sins that they'd be purified of, but they got to be
It's
purified of
the
the
sins of the
community,
community.
right? And so that definitely occurs in the rituals that they're doing. So I'm just wondering if like is that how you view baptism as kind of like a personal cleansing versus the community cleansing of the washing?
Yeah, I think Well, again, it's I don't I think that that cleansing that the evangelist cleans from the blood and sins of this generation is tied to evangelism. I'm not sure that just like, Paul and Jacob in the Book of Mormon are like waving cleaning their clothes because they're preaching at people. I don't see them necessarily. I don't know. I'd have to look at that more. I'm relying on folks like Robert Alter for my readings of the Hebrew Bible and John Connor and things like that. So I'm not an expert. My understanding of ritual purity is there is kind of community, like there's impurity that exists from ourselves and our bodies and the broader community, and you can become ritually pure through the ceremonies of the temple. That is, I think, distinct from this idea that if I don't preach to you, your sin will be on me.
Well, I don't know if they have to be unrelated, though. Can't they be related in the
I'm
sense that
sure,
we're,
I'm like, absolutely, yes.
So, I mean, they're, because you have to become clean, right? And the way you become it is going out and preaching or doing your
Yeah.
duty, right?
Doing your duty. Yep.
And so, yeah, and I guess my last question, I don't know what our time is, but my last question is just on spirit birth section you were talking, as you kind of get to the end of the book, you kind of look at some more theological, cosmological ideas, and I've been following kind of interestingly the debate on whether we are children of God, spirit birth, right? Born children of God, versus this concept that Sam Brown published. I think you've published it in other places, maybe just in blogs or whatever, but this idea that maybe we're just adopted into the family of God because Joseph Smith's teachings that the spirit is not created. In your book, you kind of take a very strong stance that that's what Joseph Smith meant, was that our spirits, as we understand spirits, right, this is not a created entity, as opposed to the typical view we have in the church of perhaps having some kind of intelligence that's unembodied spiritually, that gets a spirit body and then a physical body. So where like you came down pretty hard on that point to say that Joseph Smith's theology says we are not created spiritually. Brigham Young changes that in his
So in my
view.
opinion, the evidence is overwhelming. And again, the receipts are in the footnotes. I know, so for example, friends have different views on this than I do, and have asked me, like, have written about this and have asked me to respond on it. And I think my responses are historically sound. Joseph Smith repeats himself, like, this is his best teaching in Nauvoo. It's documented all over the place. And like, we love to cite the King Follett sermon for a lot of reasons. It's like compact and tight and explicit. That's also his best documented sermon, you know. And so we have multiple witnesses across sermons, across time from 1839 to his death, where he explains how it fits in his cosmology. It's not just a one-off. It's not just like, oh, by the way, God never had the power to create spirits. He says God never had the power to create spirits, and then explains how that fits into his theodicy.
I mean, I would just, being uncreated, of course, solves the issue of the problem of evil.
Yeah, it's
But
great.
I guess the idea that what in what form we are taking is to me still open, because even Joseph Smith in the King Follett says the spirit, the mind of man, and so then it, kind of makes it a
Yeah,
little more
and
nebulous.
so, and this is where kind of like I try to historicize these beliefs. You're right. I think if you were to pull, again, do the Family Feud thing and pull church members, I think most members would come up with that sort of tripartite intelligence, spirit, human, like human birth thing.
That's me.
And we know when that idea entered Mormon thought. And we know the first presidency's reaction. They hated it. They basically told B.H. Roberts that he was just making stuff up. And he did not like that. The first presidency also didn't like the King Follett sermon and tried to suppress its publication at the time. He didn't like that either. And so he published his pamphlet on the King Follett sermon and convinced enough other leaders in the church that his position was right, that it became kind of normative. Now, other church leaders, Bruce McConkie, it drove him crazy. He hated this idea of intelligent spirit, like it just drove him bonkers. So I think there's a lot more diversity in the 20th century beliefs than we often give folks credit for. But I think you're right that the normative view today has panned out for some reason on this tripart, like intelligent spirit, physical birth development. I think that's probably normative. I would love, like, I think it's a great case study in the development of like cosmology of how an unfavored idea grows to be that way. But I still think, again, because we can demonstrate the introduction of the idea in 1896 or whatever, that it's implausible for it to have originated with Joseph Smith,
Is
especially
there,
considered how he talks about it. He says, and the Book of Abraham says, spirits are eternal.
So I guess then the question that would follow would be, how does this then affect our understanding of the purpose of gender? And of course we have this declaration in the Family Proclamation that that gender is part of our premortal, mortal, postmortal identity. I think we've typically had this view that that we become like our heavenly father, heavenly parents, right? And that we can perpetuate the species. But if there is no creation of spirits,
What are
then
we
and it's
doing?
just only adopting, then what's the role of men and women in eternities? Like,
Right. I
have
mean,
you struggled with that
yeah,
one?
why? Why is there a dyad? And I think that's a good question. I think I don't know that spirit birth solves the problem of eternal gender because you still have intelligences, and so are they gendered? So I'm not sure it solves that problem, but it does solve the problem of why gender, so that you can procreate biologically, right? So I'm often going to resist teleologies, and so I don't know. It doesn't. I'm not worried about it. I can accept the existence without sort
Trying to
of,
solve all the issues.
yeah, like that's what the like there's lots of things with dyads in the universe.
Okay.
You
Okay.
know? Yeah.
Well, thank
Thank you.
you. We're going to wrap up now, Jonathan. We want to thank you for being with us. I do have one more question, and
Shoot.
that was, how has working on this book over the last several years, as well as the decades of preparation, affected your thoughts on the temple, your family, and all of that?
Yeah, I think I'm far more invested now than I have been at any other point in my life at creating a community of saints, a community of ultimately kings and queens, priests and priestesses. But that's something that we have to do together. I think there has been kind of a pro like centrifugal Protestant forces that want us to focus on our individuality and my personal salvation, which is good to a certain extent. But for Joseph Smith, being separate and alone wasn't salvation. Being separate and alone was damnation. And so this idea that I go to church every Sunday with the intent of not just like being spiritually fed, but trying to actively build this community that ultimately that Joseph Smith imagined would be sealed together into one holy nation, a kingdom of priests.
Thank you. That's great. We appreciate you and coming on and answering our questions and
Yeah, I'm really appreciate it. Look, anytime somebody takes the time to think through anything that you produce, it's a tremendous honor. So I really appreciate it.
You bet. So that wraps it up for this episode of the podcast. Please join us again for another edition soon. This one will be published on the websites. And want to thank you, Jonathan Stapley, author of Holiness to the Lord,
Thank
published by
you.
Oxford. And that's it for Terry Hutchinson, John Gee, John Thompson. Thank you for being with us.